The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the great cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel a gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15 yards. It's made me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, Australia retained the Ashes after 18 long years of hurt thanks to Steve Smith and England playing one more game in the World Cup 2 months ago. We'll go through the 5 days at Old Trafford, like Stuart Broad running through Dave Warner and his reaction to being told he's a cheat by a member of the public for the first time on day three of the fourth test. We'll talk Pat Cummins, Smith vs. Leach, weird public anger, victory songs and Steve Harmison's. Chris Rogers is on the show to remind us that playing in England is actually all about Manus Labuschagne, and hashtag RCGC involves batting awards, pushing your son on the swings, mistaken identities, and how to deal with being the cricketer in your office. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined by Dave Edwards in Sydney and Sam Perry in Melbourne. Boys, how does everyone feel now that the Ashes are officially staying in Australia until, well, I suppose at least 2021?
G'day, boys. I hope I speak on behalf of many Australians here. It was a deep and viscerally beautiful feeling. I walked the streets on Monday with that deep sense of joy you get when your team achieves something very difficult. We're going to talk in this cast about the different ways Australia's win is being explained. Some of them are quite funny, some of them are silly, and there's a lot of agendas within them. But like, to my mind, it was a genuine triumph, not just set against the backdrop of Cape Town, though that's important, but like just against the pure difficulty of winning a series in England. Technical skills, application. Australian teams haven't really been able to manage it this century. I think it's their best achievement since the final frontier win against India in 2004. And they should feel deeply satisfied by it. And we, by extension and by uncontrollable luck, who were born into this particular nation state, are too permitted to enjoy the success as well. Finn.
Well, their success is our success, so we should all share it as a nation. I mean, what a turnaround after, you know, the horrors of Headingley. That was all just immediately extinguished. That moment when, you know, the DRS decision came through, like Josh Hazlewood's Nutri-Grain roar, just that video of them all just reacting to that decision. There was so much tension and it was just all beautifully and sweetly released in that second. You could feel it. The nation, I felt it. Waking up that morning, just the sky was clearer. I felt happier. We all feel happy. It was a bit lighter. Nervy, but I feel lighter. Yeah, definitely, infinitely lighter. Headingley rocked us, but we, the Australian team and us, we stuck to the script and we worked hard. And as we all know, if you work hard, 99% of the times you'll get cunts out.
That's the end of the show. We've done it. We've answered all the questions of Old Trafford. The sort of the storyline after the series was that Australia had been working for about 2 years on this Ashes series. It goes back to the Lehman era as well. And I was kind of thinking about this and it's kind of like, well, you know, England spent 4 years trying to win the World Cup and they did that. And Australia have like basically got rid of ODIs for the last 4 years. And they've obviously put the eggs in the Ashes 2019 basket and they've succeeded. So it kind of like seems to me that like it seems you can't be good at all three formats at the same time. You kind of have to put all your eggs in one basket. I don't really understand how or why, but I suppose that would have been, you know, Cape Town does fall into the last 2 years. Obviously, it was only 15 months ago. So, like, that would have been a huge dent into those plans. But why is that? Why is it like teams are now just focusing on one tournament 2-4 years in the future, and when they win that, then they just have a break and they think about something else?
I don't know. I think you're right. That's probably right. Like, no doubt both teams invested in different places and, like, arranged their teams accordingly. I'm sure there's some level of conquering thing. Like, I think the story of Australian test cricket, well, it's sort of like cricket in Australia, at least this century and beforehand, is test cricket is still probably the pinnacle thing. But Australia has won the World Cup 4 times. So I don't think that it's just quite simply there just wasn't that same drive.
Don't need it.
To win it again in England in a situation where England hadn't won one at all. And they'd set themselves up for this golden summer led by the World Cup, but then following up with the Ashes victory. So, and like they, it's all, you know, Test cricket is just all about winning series away from home. Everyone kind of wins their series at home. I know there are outliers and stuff, particularly with Australia and South Africa, where the decks are quite similar. But really, like that India, Australia, England thing, if you can go over there and adapt your techniques and beat their best players on their home patch, that's kind of, I think in Australian cricket, that's kind of been the thing that we've not been able to do. So that's, I think that's why Australia went that way.
Yeah, because I wonder, Eddows, let me put it to you, that like maybe Australia saw England clearly focusing on winning the World Cup and they're like, we can get them here. Like we can get England here. And like, look how well Australia have played. I would say they have outplayed England in four test matches in a row, including the one that they lost, and Stokes has had an absolute worldie, including, you know, coupled with one of the worst umpiring decisions of all time. But like, look how well Australia have played to try and win this series, and they've only just about done it, you know? So like, maybe they saw England focusing all the energies into the World Cup. England in their test squad, they got counted seven guys who played the World Cup. Australia have six. So like,
right,
there's no World Cup hangover. England played one more game. So, but Australia focused all the energies into the Ashes. Thoughts?
Well, yeah, but you've also got to give credit to, you know, Pat Howard. I think he's the one that deserves this. And I've noticed on social that the Pat Howard revisionism has commenced and he's been credited for this Ashes victory. I think he did bring in the Duke's ball at shield level, even though the ball fundamentally behaves differently in Australian wickets and conditions. So maybe it's not really the same thing, whatever. But, you know, in time, Pat Howard will be remembered as one of the great visionaries of our game. And everyone looks good after enough time has passed. I think enough time has passed for us to, you know, give him all the credit for our victory.
All right, so to Old Trafford, they picked Mitchell Starc. That seemed to be a little bit surprising. Didn't bowl well in the first innings. Well, he sort of came back on the second day when he cleaned up Bairstow especially. So he came back all right. So you kind of have to say that the selectors have done a pretty incredible job for Australia throughout this entire series. They've picked Labuschagne into the squad, who seems to be a long-term number three for Australia. He's going to be in the top order anyway for the next little while, you suspect. They've rotated the bowlers expertly. And I don't think they've made a single bad decision just yet, have they?
They got there, like, I think you have to give it to Justin Langer. Yeah. People are going to have different views on him and his style, and there's a lot that's able to be mined there comedically with Justin Langer, and will be over a long period of time. But, like, he's, as you said, he has selected beautifully, and then the way that they went about the series tactically by, I guess, foregoing that idea of, like, overlaying the Australian way, you know, of playing and being a bit humble about the conditions and then the way they'd play. So, you know, all of a sudden Peter Siddle was a far more appealing prospect than Mitchell Starc, you know. That's a great symbol of that. But then finding the right time to bring Starc in, I mean, he did kind of wobble a little bit, didn't he, when he started playing. But at the end of the day, he's hit 50 not out. He's got Stokes out, which in first innings, which is no small feat given the way Ben Stokes has inflicted a permanent scar on our psyche as a nation forever. He was the one who was able to get Stokes out. He got Bairstow out twice. And so you have to say it's a good selection. He was, you know, he was the horse for that course with a bit of reverse swing. So they've done remarkably well. And I think Langer deserves a shed load of praise. I know we're going to talk in a second about the way the series is being explained, but I think it's a genuine, unadulterated triumph.
Eddows, I was kind of thinking that, you know, England, I think England have had three excellent performers throughout the series. Obviously Stokes. Rory Burns has been a surprise. He's been fantastic. Really, I think they've got a long-term replacement there for the next couple of winter tours, the top of the order. But also Stuart Broad has been fucking incredible in this series. And, like, I'm just looking at the way that he's bowling to Warner, and it's kind of funny because it's a bit like watching Jason Roy bat where you're like, something's going to happen every single ball. And for poor old Davey, not many balls, to be fair. But Broad has bowled some absolute peaches to him.
It's a real worry, isn't it, about Davey? Yeah, Broad absolutely tied him up this whole series. I mean, Warner had a good World Cup, but he's lost it, this Ashes, hasn't he? I mean, Broad got inside his head and he's exposed this weakness. I mean, we talked about horses for courses. Maybe we just have to stop picking him to tour England because, you know, based on evidence, and evidence and data is important these days, he hasn't really done very well over in England. And there's a few blokes, actually, that we probably should just put a black line through for future Ashes tour. So maybe that's a takeaway. But, you know, I mean, even though David Warner averaged 9, that won't stop him celebrating this victory harder than he ever has, because it's often the blokes who contribute the least that celebrate the hardest, because yeah. they're also like drinking to mask that pain. I mean, it's a cocktail of pleasure and pain. And that's what he's You've having right now. That.
Yeah, like, because he's got 21 test tons, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And,
Or some shit.
But but ultimately, whenever Stuart Broad is playing against him, like, that career average otherwise doesn't really count. I mean, he effectively averages 9 when Stuart Broad's playing. So that's what you can now expect when he plays. I guess it would have been really interesting to see what they would have done with him were the series still alive. But I think now that it's over, they'll just play him. And because he's an absolute lock for an Australian summer where he'll probably score 500s and compensate.
It's going to be great.
Deeply.
Well, I can sort of see Warner and Khawaja opening the batting for Australia in the summer and having Labuschagne at 3. Didn't think that was going to be the case about 2 weeks ago. And then Smith at 4, Head 5. You know, it's probably going to be a bat off, as it always is, the beginning of the Australian summer for 6. You know, Wade's the incumbent. But, I mean, another battle that was sort of hotly contested, well, hotly talked about leading up to the Test match was Smith versus Archer. Archer's had a funny one because he's bowled one unbelievable spell, and he hasn't really bowled that well since. You know, it kind of shows, like, he's just this raw talent, and undoubtedly he's going to be amazing when he comes to Australia, when he travels all around the world. He's going to get better when he comes to England. You know, there's probably a likely chance that Jason Gillespie, who's working at Sussex, is going to be the next England coach. You know, Joff Rutch is going to get better, but right now I feel like he's kind of just raw talent that isn't... Well, he's played well in one game, I suppose, out of 3 so far. Is that fair?
Yeah. I don't think it's fair to say one game out of 3. I think he did bowl more than one good spell, but that first spell, the way he burst onto the scene, made you think, wow, is that your baseline? Because if so, we're fucked.
Yeah.
This is Space Jam shit. You've literally just knocked out Bradman.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get you out, so I'll just knock you out. And I was like, that was, in many ways, you know, as an Australian,
that was frightening.
That's scarier. So, but then it was deeply surprising in this game to see him commence that first spell the way that he did, and like really quite mind-boggling. And it wasn't even really like it wasn't able to be explained by a lot of the more seasoned professionals as well who were commentating at the time. And I'm not even sure if it has that much since, other than look, the conditions weren't that conducive. It was cold. It was a blustery wind. It is hard to run in, especially if you've bowled 50 overs in the previous test. Like I guess that's right. But even so, like you could see with him as well that he really did pick it up once Smith came in to bat. So he'd obviously got himself really wound up for that particular contest. But, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about Smith in 1 second. Nobody's doing anything to Steve Smith for a little while, I think. We said that he'd compensate for that year out. I didn't think it'd be like this. Like, he might go. he could hit a triple ton in this next match as well. Bat first and just let him go.
Okay, so I want to get into the next bit, which does include sort of Warner-Smith and Payne. And Payne's obviously contribution in the first innings was fairly pivotal. 50, 60, something like that, batting for a long time with Steve Smith, sort of taking the game away from England. Now, like, I understand opposition's, you know, disliking the opposition captain. Home fans disliking the opposition captain. It happens all the time here. But, like, I really don't understand the anger towards Tim Payne from, like, English fans. They hate him. They really hate Tim Payne. I can't think of, like, anything he's ever said. He doesn't carry on. He's not, like... I mean, I can sort of understand why English fans didn't like Ponting. It was kind of like... First of all, he was really good, so you automatically dislike him. But Ponting was, like... He was quite aggressive on the field, and there was a few times where maybe he took things a little bit too far, possibly. But Payne is, like... I just don't understand it. And there's, like, this theme going on in the Ashes where, like... There is, like, so much anger coming from both sides, Australia and England. But I suppose you sense it a bit more in England because they're the home team. But, like, towards Payne, I honestly don't understand it.
Well, I mean, he's a villain that they don't understand. I mean, English people like typical Australian pantomime villains that they do understand, like a Ponting or a Warner, you know, a rabid attack dog in the field who, you know, demonstrates wildly with his body language, and they understand that they can hate that. But Tim Payne is very English in many ways. He presents well. He's got a lovely lid, beautiful skin, speaks very well, obviously educated. And they don't quite know how to take that, but you know, the default reaction is to obviously hate it aggressively, and that's what they're doing at the moment.
Okay, so Pez, you go.
I mean, he made that Edgbaston comment at the start, and, you know, he deeply offended the Birmingham faithful by suggesting that it wasn't in the top 15 grounds or whatever for intimidation. But I think, like, they tried to line him up this series as, like, a real weak link. You know, he's not as good as Carey's played well. His average isn't that great. He's only scored one first-class touch. They kept banging on about that. And also, like, he was going to be the lightning rod for this idea that, like, you know, that Australia are actually still shit blokes when they're trying to say that they're good. And I think that was one of the great, like, narratives that has tried to be prosecuted with Australia being over there. They're like, oh, we're looking for any opportunity to demonstrate you guys actually are still terrible people because it's one of the main things that we are able to hold over you. And even on that account, I think they were scraping the barrel, really. I do think the Australian side behaved themselves way better than a lot of their predecessors would have, especially after that Headingley loss. You just think of some of the old sides losing like that, absolutely lost their minds at that loss. You know, like the venom, the vitriol. I can see the spit coming out of some of the old players' mouths
through
now.
Dressing room doors.
Exactly. And he was kind of, you know, Payne wasn't that. And then, you know, even now, like, to rub salt into that wound as well, he made a really valuable contribution to the match as well. You know, in that first innings, Smith was looking for a partner. He hit 58 and took the score from sort of 220 to 360 and just put them out of sight a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, now averages are coming through showing, oh, actually, he's got this sort of equal second highest average of a wicketkeeper, you know, in Australian history since sort of World War II. So, you know, after Gilchrist, he's sort of even with Haddon. And then after that, he's got Healy and Rod Marsh covered. So you're sort of struggling to find a hole for him, really. He's the way he's brought the team together after Cape Town. There's no, I mean, as people who've played grade cricket and knowing what Aussies are like, and we sort of, you know, ridicule it endlessly here on the show, mercilessly. Like, he has done extremely well to bring him together.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, like, Payne is a wartime leader, isn't he? And I don't think enough Australians appreciate that we have been at war, you know, in a cricketing sense. The past 2 years, it's just been unbelievable tumult, you know, from the tampering scandal onwards, and, you know, the upheaval of half of CA, not to mention Smith's ban. And, you know, we're still in a trying time here, but fuck me, CA has got to be happy with Payne, because he has just delivered on every KPI they could have possibly imagined. From our perspective, we've just got to give him the keys to the city, or whatever it is we do these days. I've never really understood.
Well, this is a really good question. Is there a ticker? I mean, this has got to be ticker tape parade worthy. It's been a long time. Yeah. I mean, this whole Ashes, what they've achieved is brought
me still
back
give
to
keys
the 90s.
To the city?
Are there keys and ticker tape? Yeah.
That's hard because it's footy finals time. So, you know, maybe if West Coast don't make the finals, I don't know. It could be. It just probably depends how the AFL pans out, really. Okay.
Doing Perth,
next up.
Well, just ask the AFL.
What's Gillen think?
Yeah. okay, next. Steve Smith. Pez, you've rightly said before Smith came back, you thought that he was just going to be like insanely crazy hungry to just break all the records and make up for all lost time. I have never seen – I sort of went about a year ago. I was like, nah, Kohli's a better batsman than Smith. And like, part of me still is like tuned into that like classical sense, probably prefer to watch, you know, Kohli and Smith's weird and stuff. But like, what Smith is doing is completely unparalleled in any batsman I've ever seen, home or away, England, India, Australia. It doesn't matter where. You know, peak Brian Lara never did this. Like, it is insane what he's doing. I think if he scores, I think it's something like 300 runs at the Oval, he'll break Bradman's record for most runs ever in a series. And keep in mind, he hasn't batted for three innings in this test series. So remarkable stuff. Now, there's obviously not enough superlatives to talk about his batting, but what I'm interested in here is, like he's still getting booed. Like, it's still going on. And, like, you can dress it up as, like, you know, Old Trafford rises as one. And don't get me wrong, there's probably 95% of the people who hate the booing. It's embarrassing. But, like, there's still a significant number of people who are still abusing the guy who is just absolutely the best since Bradman.
Yeah. You're right on there being no more superlatives. I don't, like, it's completely, there's, you know, every generation kind of has a best since Bradman person,
true.
But the stats are literally backing it up.
Yep.
And like, can he get better? He's about to have an Australian summer, probably on flat wickets, where the bowlers will request that the wickets are flat so that they can put their feet up for a few days while Smith hits 400. Mm. Can he start touching Bradman statistically? maybe he might get that. He might get a triple ton at the Oval, and beat that 974. Mm-hmm. On the booing. I guess it's happening to Warner as well. Like, I mean, to sort of have it right, like, the initial novelty of it, like, wasn't actually so bad. It was to be expected. We talked about it. People, like, love having a go at the Aussies. And like, what happened in Cape Town was a genuine case of, like, 40 years of being terrible blokes, mm-hmm. institutionally speaking, mm-hmm. and having a punishment that somehow addressed that as well. Mm. And now these guys are the kind of lightning rods for it. Like, I thought the initial novelty of it wasn't so bad, but like the persistence of it now, four tests in, post the World Cup, starting to get a bit embarrassing. Mm. And like, it's a bit folly to enter into like very, very tedious social comparisons, but like, you wouldn't put much boorishness past Aussie crowds as well. True. You know, that getting into the water battery is very, very silly. Absolutely. But stick my neck out here. Like, I genuinely think if the shoe was on the other foot, all things being equal, that I don't think that Aussie crowds would be seen to boo a bloke four tests in who's hit a double ton in the circumstances that he had. Like, and maybe that's out of a sporting education thing. Mm. I don't know.
I think that's right about the sporting education and the reluctant. Yeah. Begrudging applause that we give people for dominating.
Like, even the worst Bogan, I reckon, would be shouted down by probably a Warn and stuff. And that was the thing I found interesting. There's been a few pieces of commentary without wanting to highlight any specifically that have kind of suggested, the crowd rises as one, as you said, here goes. Mm. And it's like, no, it's not. I can hear fucking booing. Not everyone's doing it. You know, like, don't pretend. And I know a lot of people find it a bit, find it really unbecoming. Like, English tribune can't speak for everybody. But, four tests in.
I just wonder if people have like bought the tickets for the fourth test match. They bought these months ago and they're going, this is my day out. Yeah. This is my time. I'm going to give to this bloke, you know? And like, I found it funny, like when Lyon was like getting the ball thrown back to him on that first or second day, whenever they first bowled, and they were cheering when he caught the ball. I was like, it was like 3 a.m. and I was like, that is legitimately funny. Like, I laughed at that.
That's funny.
It was like the third day in a row, and like, obviously the 2 days who after the first day it happened, those crowds had just been watching the TV and they saw it happen. They're like, oh, I want to do that as well. So it's like, you can't like sort of begrudge people like, you're having their day out at the cricket. You know, it's 1 day a year, you go to a test match.
But
it's
English people love that. You know, they love it in a Premier League match when someone does a pass that just doesn't go to the bloke and everyone does an ironic cheer. Mm. Like, they just love that little bit of failure. But they need to get off their high horse and realise, you know, better than us, England. I mean, on the tampering stuff, yes, we did it. Smith kind of oversaw it. But the English team used mints to get the ball to swing in 2005. And we should all just accept that we're all fucking cheats. And if it makes you feel good to boo Australia or, you know, call Australians convicts, which is a strange insult, I think, in today's globalised society, and probably one that says more about you than does about us, whatever, go ahead and do it. But at the end of the day, we've completed the Ashes.
Well, I find it.
So with on the line stuff, like, I can still even get that a little bit, like 3 or 4 days in, because the difference between, say, Lyon and Smith is where I'm coming from, the booing, is like, and I'll throw Warner into this with Lyon as well, like, you can make an argument that those guys don't have as many redeeming qualities,
sure.
Right?
Yeah,
I wouldn't necessarily, but I can see why Lyon grinds people's gears, and you can definitely see it with Warner.
Yeah.
So you can make that, make that argument.
Absolutely.
Smith is being aloof and like, historically dominant and not causing anybody else any other problems. Mm. So that's, I just think, like, particularly after like a double ton, it's like, you got to give it to him. But maybe that's funny, and maybe the commitment to the joke, you know, this is deep comedy. Mm. You just got to commit to the joke forever.
Mm. Okay, well, we'll get into Smith's comedic styles in a second. But like, I mean, we also saw the image of Warner coming out of the dressing room after lunch on day 3, I think it might have been, and someone yelled out, Warner, you fucking cheat, and he just like turned around and just gave her the big thumbs up, and it's like, what? Like, that's kind of sums it up. They've been getting this. They've been in England for fucking 3 years, it feels like, Australia. Like, at what point does that guy think, like, I'm going to get him. I'm going to get Warner. I'm going to get him. He's going to fail. I mean, it's worked, to be fair. Broad's got him out a lot, so, you know, maybe fair play.
yeah.
one of the great reactions by Warner. Probably the best thing he's done all tour. That was really, really good.
I mean, I feel like, because we copped a lot of heat during, let's insert ourselves into the story.
Let's do it.
We copped a lot of heat, especially myself, during the World Cup for being perceived to be like English cheerleaders a little bit. But you probably sense on this show that it's actually quite like the opposite. And it's, I don't know about you guys, but I'm sort of observing a number of like sort of a bit disingenuous or coded arguments, just trying to detract a little bit from what I think is just a comprehensive triumph. Like, you know, firstly, like Smith is a cyborg. Smith is this outlier. You know, if you didn't have him, it'd be a different story.
Dehumanizing him.
Well, kind of, it's like, well, that's exactly it. It's like, he's still in the team. He's still a product of the country. You're allowed
but
to own
machine,
that.
He's like Ivan Drago. Like,
exactly. You wouldn't be like, you know, well, the Bulls wouldn't have gone as well without Jordan.
Yeah.
It's like, no, they wouldn't, but he played for them. Yeah.
He was fit and available, and, we picked him.
There's still these, you know, Smith is eccentric but exceptional. It's like, why but? Is and like he's this peculiar batsman. No, he's wonderful. If you can't find anything interesting about the way he bats, you're not watching closely enough. But it's like he looks bad. Then there's, you know, you hear well, we won the World Cup. You know, there's a bit of that as well. Oh, there's going to be a bit of a hangover. They're a bit cooked. But, you know, there's the other point of like Vitush Nahanthorajan made a really good point on the Guardian Spin podcast the other day saying, well, you know, like Headingley doesn't happen without the World Cup as well, you know, with Stokes. So I'm not sure how much it carries over. You know, you've got the guys are still cheats. That's the Harmison angle. He'll always be remembered as cheats. I don't know if Smith's going to be remembered that much as a cheat with what he's doing. And then the other one people are saying is, well, it should be 4-0, really. It's like,
They're not banging on about things like mother. Like, wasn't Tim Bresnan talking about mother cricket? And, you know, implying there's some karma to, like, just relax, stop thinking about this stuff. It just doesn't make sense. There's no mother cricket thing.
I like to think
cricket's
about
a funny
cricket.
Game. Firstly, cricket's not a funny game.
Nothing funny.
Not cricket's not a funny. Mother either. It's a. What a family member is cricket? There's not been a mother to me.
Isn't it sexist as well? Yeah, like a spiteful woman whose sole purpose is to wreak havoc karmically.
Well, it's been a difficult stepfather to me.
It's kind of like very Justin Langery. I want to get you guys' take on the celebrations afterwards. We saw Steve Smith wearing glasses, and apparently he was reenacting Jack Leach's reenactment of his single at Headingley. I find that interesting that like Smith was happy for that to be seen. Like he hasn't kind of hit that. Like it's been well documented a number of times when like journalists are still in the press box after the day's play and they're you know filing or whatever so it was like seen and like he was photographed and he was filmed like wearing glasses and it was fairly obvious that he was openly mocking Leach, which is an interesting thing because he's like Leach has obviously become a cult hero in the UK and you know rightfully so. So I haven't really seen Smith do that before.
I reckon Smith's got levels. I reckon he's got a couple of levels to him. I think he might be a little bit funnier and have a few things. Like I reckon he could hold up his own end a little bit. But I mean, I reckon on the Leach thing. I mean, we're going to talk to Chris Rogers in a second about that. But if he lets us. But I reckon it was curious because I thought the way England celebrated that win against that Headingley win was fine. It was such a like an amazing victory that you're going to have fun with it. You know, it's only a short career you live, and they're always going to do some banterous things. But I can also see the Australian team looking at it, going, "Oh, that's interesting," and just in true Australian classic fashion, or I guess English as well, just repressing that, keeping that stored away for later, to then toxically mock it.
Yeah.
So yeah,
yeah. I just love the complete absence of context for it to be a Chris Rogers gag. Like why? Exactly. There's no context to that. Like, he was definitely mocking Leach, and he had every right to do so. I mean, Leach lapped up the moment. That's fine. The cameras were on him. That's what you do when you do something and cameras are around. If it's going to come back and get you, that's a shame. It kind of reminded me of how David Warner punched Joe Root in a walkabout bar all those years, and he said it was because Joe Root was wearing a wig on his chin. And then Warner saw that as like a slight on, Hashim Amla?
Hashim Amla. That's exactly what happened, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That wasn't what it was. You just wanted to punch a bloke. But Warner also barked at a dog like a dog against that faff duplessis in South Africa.
He barked at a dog too. I wouldn't put it past him. Just walking past Davey Maroubra one day, he's just barking at a dog. Right, we're going to speak to Chris Rogers before we lose him. So we get him on the line, and then after that, hashtag ICGC.
Kat actually wrote a three-part fan fiction series a few years ago entitled The Choke, which looked at the fallout from the dressing room altercation between yourself and Michael Clark. And clearly this incident split the team into two lines, you know, much like Christos Tsiolkos's novel The Slap. Can I send that to you for feedback? Because I think you'll like it.
I think you've just got good feedback, haven't you?
Fan fiction.
Okay, boys, it's our pleasure to welcome back to the show one of our very best friends, I think. Never sure with ex-players. He was a run glutton at all levels. We miss him on the airwaves dearly, but to be fair, he's currently doing something far more helpful for cricket in Australia, teaching the young guns how to bat. I'm, of course, talking about Chris Rogers. Buck, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me.
Can you just describe briefly, Buck, where you are at the moment, who you're with, what you're doing?
I'm in the Little Hunter restaurant in the centre of Adelaide. I'm having a steak and a glass of Pinot with Ryan Harris. So not the worst night I can remember, that's for sure.
Who made the decision to pair a Pinot with
Ryan Harris?
And Ryan Harris.
He's much more experienced in this field than me, so I let him to yeah.
What are you, just to steer this completely off track from the plan, but like, you know, people around the nation and even into the UK will be wondering whether you guys are catching, you know, having a celebratory Pinot following the Ashes win, or are you just two blokes who hate talking about cricket?
Yes, for some reason the conversation still goes around cricket, especially when we've won an Ashes series. But, we actually were at my brother's place that night in Perth, having a drink and watching Australia win. So it's been a good few days, that's for sure.
What do you make of it, mate? I mean, you're involved in the system now as well, so you can probably take a little bit of credit for everything that's gone into the planning and the way sort of CA have prepared the players and sort of changing the system. I mean, what does the Ashes win mean to you?
Yeah, I did a heap of coaching with all those senior blokes. It had pretty much nothing to do with them. So, but I have seen a lot of the work that's gone into it. I get to see it pretty, you know, the real detail and all the data that they look at. And there's so much more that goes into it than you'd probably believe, but the fact that they've won and watching the prep and how they're going about it is probably no surprise. So, it's been an excellent effort. I guess going into it, from my own experience, I thought it was going to be tough and maybe we just weren't going to be able to handle the conditions that well. But I think with the planning, particularly the way we've gone about with the bowling and controlling the run rate, that's been a real key. The way the English guys have gone with the bat has been pretty average. So all credit to the staff for the Australian side who have done such a good job.
Mm. And it's obviously been 18 long years that we've had to wait to win over there. I mean, obviously you played a couple of series over there yourself in one of those unsuccessful tours. I mean, does it kind of, now you've like seen how Australia have done it and how actually hard it is to win over there. Now, I'm sure that it was obviously, you're obviously very aware how hard it was when you were actually playing in those series, but kind of like seeing how Australia have done it. And even though they've played so well, they've still kind of, you know, scraped at a couple of results. Like, do you sort of appreciate even more how hard it is to actually win in England from an Australian perspective?
The funny thing is when you retire, how quickly you've forgotten, because I actually played in two series, not the one, yeah. But I'll pull you up on that. But, it is so difficult because the English guys know the conditions so well. I mean, when I played in there, they had the likes of Broad and Anderson who were just it's just impossible to play at times, and then the batsman would get the job done. And you felt, I think, particularly in 2015, we felt we were going in as almost favourites. But we got turned over and we just played the wrong style of play. That was probably the most disappointing thing. It was good to see that, the Australian side realised they had to change their ways. They couldn't play the Australian way in England. They had to play the England way, and I think they did that.
Yeah, I mean, Bucky, speaking as a former opening batsman, our opening partnerships were not good this series at all. If you want to just offer a bit of a review on the opening situation we've got here at the moment, I mean, David Warner, you could see the way he laughed after he got trapped in front in the second innings of the last test. I mean, he just feels nothing is going his way. So just, just the opening situation for Australia at the moment, and also just on Warner, technically speaking, what's going on there?
I kind of suggested, I think I remember saying at one stage that, the side who wins the first test and gets a little bit of form is a good chance to go through and win the series, just because in those series it feels like you need to get a little bit of form early, because trying to get form in the middle of that series, it feels almost impossible, just because you're facing such high quality bowling and the ball is moving so much that you're never getting an easy run. So I look at Davey and I just think he didn't start well. I know he had that one innings where he got 60, I think, or 70, but apart from that, and even then he was lucky, I think, for a lot of it. So it just looks like he's a guy short of confidence, and it's almost the worst place to be, because it just feels like the ball is swinging round corners. It may not look it, but when you're out in the middle, it just feels like the ball is doing everything, and you don't know if it's going to actually hit the bat. So I feel a little bit sorry for him. Not too much, knowing who he is, but we were exchanging a few messages today, just seeing how it's going. So he's still in pretty good spirits. He's pretty resilient. I think he'll come through it. Albeit, I know he'll be extremely disappointed at this, because I think he'll be thinking about, his legacy a little bit, and he's never particularly done well in England, which will hurt him quite a lot, I reckon.
And just at the other end of the spectrum, Bucky, one guy who has done well is Smith. I mean, we were just saying earlier that the superlatives have kind of run out for him, but as a very, very successful professional and international cricketer, where does Steve Smith rate for you? What's he doing with his batting that we're not seeing? Is there anything you can offer that hasn't already been said?
He's pretty good, isn't he? I don't know. It is unbelievable. I think, to watch how he's going before, I guess, South Africa, and you'd say, look, he's as good as Kohli, as good as anyone in the world. But then to come back and after he's been what he's been through, and to be even better, and to lay claim to number one outright, it's just such unbelievable achievement. You only have to look at how he goes about it, and his manic movements, and that he's a little bit crazy. There's probably a few wires that aren't connected quite right, but it just helps him become the best player in the world, doesn't it? It takes a certain type, I think, to be that way inclined. And you watch him train; he hits more balls than anyone I've ever seen, and just has this deep desire to be better than anyone, and it's shown through. But it's just as a coach, trying to coach young players and watching them all now come and bat like Steve Smith, I think it's cooked us a little bit, because you just don't know how to coach this method. It's so unique, and there's certain things I think he does that we still don't understand. So I don't know if we're going to get a whole generation of players playing like him and how that's going to turn out, but I think we're going to find out.
Shit. So it's going to be like when Shane Warne retired, and we just spent like a decade searching for the next Shane Warne, and then we got like 16 off spinners who played 3 tests each. It's going to be a dearth.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But how did you go with the crowds over there? Obviously, you played a whole heap of county cricket over there, so I imagine you've been quite well accepted. But obviously, it's been like quite a lot of aggression, obviously for obvious reasons, towards certain Australian guys. But I mean, how did you go in the UK crowds over there? Did you spend much time on the boundary, sort of sweeping up, and then sort of coming to the dressing rooms at tea time and sharing some stories about what was being said, or did the crowd sort of react to you quite lovingly?
I was always pretty slow, so I found a way to stay inside the circle because you didn't really want to be on the boundary. You tend to cop it. I was out there one time. I had my glasses on and they were singing "There's Only One Harry Potter." But apart from that, I didn't, aren't they? Yeah, I didn't cop it too much. Mitchell Johnson was the one. I think that the fact that he even played on past the 2015 series surprised me a bit. He didn't last much longer, but they would start singing. They had two songs for him. They would start singing them at 11 o'clock when the first ball was bowled, and then wouldn't finish till 6:30 when the last ball was bowled. And it was pretty much all about him. So how he managed to get himself through that, and then he'd get it in the street as well. So it was to watch how he had to deal with that was interesting. But the other thing is that, you know, they were singing at 6:30, still thinking it was the funniest thing ever. When at that stage it was like, mate, shut up, it's not funny.
Tell me to shut up here as well, but you mentioned wearing the glasses, and I'm just thinking, you know, it must be a real honour for you to have been referenced by the great demigod Steve Smith at the night celebrations, as we've all seen on the internet, being clarified by the photographer Ryan Pearce that Smith wearing glasses was actually referencing you, you know, on the Old Trafford pitch and not Jack Leach. That must be quite touching.
Yeah, really touching, yeah. He actually I'm dropping all sorts of names at the moment, but he sent me that pic. I woke up to that pic this morning saying he'd done it in honour of me. Whether I'm a smokescreen, I'm not exactly sure, but I was touched anyway to have got a message from him. So they looked like they were having fun. I think after we won the Ashes in Perth in 13-14, I managed to take a catch. I went and reenacted the catch by taking catching a beer bottle at the time. So, mate, all these things come around, you know, that it all happens. I don't know why people are getting so offended. Who cares? It was all a bit of fun.
Oh, I was just going to pick up on the circuiting theme, Buck. I mean, we presume that the Australian cricketers are still on it. do you have any indication? I mean, you said you've got a text from Steve Smith. Have you got any subsequent texts? Any Snapchats?
No, I think he probably turned his phone off after that.
It's been a disturbing lack of media around the circuit, though. I mean, usually we get little tidbits here and there, or, you know, naked runs through the set of the Today Show or some kind of unusual stuff. Nothing.
Yeah, just not turning up to events the next day. But we've all been there. But, I imagine they celebrated well, but they've got another couple of days before another test, and then I imagine there might be a couple in Ibiza or somewhere like that afterwards. So who knows what they'll do then.
That was a very specific place to mention. But, speaking of dropping names, I don't know if you're sitting still across from you, but does Rhino have a view on whether Cummins' ball to root is now better than his to Cook? And if he hasn't said anything, you could just ask him on air.
Every time that ball comes on, he still says it's the best ball ever bowled, the one that he bowled. So I'm pretty sure he said to me tonight he thought the root played around the one from
didn't get forward, did he? Yeah.
That's why he organised the catch-up, just to tell you that.
Oh, that's quite good. Oh, well, thanks for being a good sport with that, Bucky. Any other questions, Dave? Here goes.
No.
We'll let you get back to the Pinot, mate. Enjoy the Pinot and the steak, and thanks for the insights.
Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me.
Lots of laughs as well.
I love the Twitter account. It's great. I follow it a great deal, and even while I understand not even half of it, I still love it.
What perfect endorsement could you have?
That was Chris Rogers. A wonderful conversation. You can just see him enjoying that Pinot with Rhino Harris. And Joe Root, yeah, he just played around it. Just look, an influx of pictures come our way these days because we talk about budgie smuggler every week and just people who like to point out to us that people wear budgie smugglers while playing sport and stuff. And, you know, it's not really sure what to do with it half the time or most of the time, but I guess it underlines the point that there is an increase in budgie smuggler wearing. I guess, you know, as friends of budgie smuggler, that's great to see. I thought I'd ask, because it's never really made sense to me too much, or I've not really understood. Like, it's a bit of a pro sport thing, isn't it, wearing budgie smugglers, boys? Mm-hmm. It's something that sort of, as you climb higher up that hierarchy of sport, you see it more and more. What's the upside of wearing budgie smugglers while playing sport as a man?
Well, everything is compressed. I first noticed this in the footballing realm, that, like, football players, I mean, because obviously they're getting tackled and getting pulled from all directions, and so, like, the budgie, yep, will, it's the hardest undergarment to remove. You know, if you're popping on some CKs, you know, underneath your footy shorts or your whites or, you know, whatever, like, those things will just get yourself exposed, and in the wrong kind of way, not just technically but also emotionally. So that's why people wearing budgie smugglers as professional athletes. Keep yourself locked in.
I think, yeah, well, definitely the locked-in aspect, but also with cricket, and there is a proliferation of cricketers wearing budgie smugglers, very colourful budgie smugglers. Obviously, in cricket, you have to wear white clothing all day, and there's no opportunity to really showcase your personality, you know, other than in conversation with people. So you have to show it somehow, and you can just see the faint outline of budgies under whites in some cases. I have seen the budgies visible under Ben Stokes, a huge unofficial brand ambassador of budgie smuggler. So I guess it's the opportunity to showcase a little bit of your personality under your pants.
Okay, thanks for answering that question for me in this targeted advertisement. If you would like some budgie smugglers, please visit budgiesmuggler.com.au. Ben Stokes does it, so does Nathan Lyon.
All right, let's roll straight into hashtag RCGC. But beforehand, we're going to speak about a couple of things. As we mentioned the other week about, you know, people doing their pre-season, you know, pre-season awards evening. No one's doing a pre-season award evening. You can't give out awards before the season started, although we all know who's going to win best and fairest each season, highest run scorer, that sort of thing, most ducks. You can pretty much lock those in now, can't you, listeners at home? But you know, the functions are coming up, and you can reach out to the Great Cricketer at greatcricketer.club to speak at your pre-season function or your Christmas party or what's happening at any time throughout the year. Every club has a fundraiser of some description.
Got a lot last week.
Just go on.
Yeah. Sorry, that's a complete interruption. I was just adding that we got a surprising number of inquiries last week as well, and obviously the social window for pre-season is a smallish one. Mm-hmm. So if you are interested in having one, two, or three of us, offer content after 1974, then, you know, don't ask Rodney Hogg, ask us. Love you, Hoggy.
Although we would be open to doing a mix-up with Rodney Hogg if you've got the budget to hire both Rodney Hogg and the Great Cricketers. You know, we might be able to interview him. You know, we might be able to just chat with him. You know, maybe just a bit of banter, a bit of ad-lib stuff.
Yeah.
He's doing a bit of climate stuff at the moment.
Well, I think we could have an intellectual debate, you know, Bill and Allison style.
The great debate, yeah.
Yeah.
An academic decathlon.
Yeah, exactly. At no point did you answer the question, and may God have mercy on your soul, et cetera, et cetera. Greatcricketer.club is where you can also get merchandise. Obviously, we released a very small run of stubby holders, which are almost all gone. Greatcricketer.club, get those in. And we're going to be touring the country again during the summer, and those shows are going to be announced very shortly. I'd imagine in the next week or so. I should know the exact dates of when those will be announced, but we'll be on the road again, so look out for those. Greatcricketer.club for all that information there. It's the best way to contact us, etc., etc. All right, let's get into hashtag AskTGC. And we've got four of the best here, lads. And I'll kick this one off from Joe Robinson, who says, "Our season has ended in England, and we have a problem that possibly only the Great Cricketer can solve. Despite having five batters averaging over 30 and one of our players being the third highest run scorer in the division, our batting award has been won by one of our bowlers who has scored 42 runs and been dismissed only once. Said bowler has also been keenly gaming the system over the past month, asking to be dropped down the order, and in one game batting mysteriously slowly in a tight game we ended up losing, whilst he of course got his not out. Should we call an EGM to change the club rules before the awards? Should we refuse to hand out a batting award for the season? Should we abandon the concept of awards entirely as being part of an overly individualistic society when team performance is all that matters? Any advice is welcome. That comes from Joe.
Okay, so I'm presuming that like the current policy around the awarding of the batting award is simply he who has the highest average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So either change the title of the award.
Yeah.
Or change the policy around what it represents. Because if you call it batting award, you've got wiggle room there. Batting award doesn't mean average. Couldn't it mean aggregate? Sorry for the, completely uncreative answer. But it seems a bit strange that your batting award is entirely based on who has the highest average. I mean, averages, could be gamed massively.
Yeah.
Look at Bradman.
It is shocking. And Bradman did game the system to achieve 99.94. You're right there. Look, I don't know. I mean, you should give him the award, I think, but just make as many underhanded references as possible to how he is gaming the system. Just make him feel terrible. Bullying, they call it in some circles. So everyone just point and laugh at him when he accepts the award. That'd be good.
I would change the name of the award to the Most Selfish Award. That seems like a more...
You have to hand out the award to everyone.
We'll see if he hides himself down the order after that.
Yeah.
I don't know why I have to say that like I was at silly mid off. Okay, Clint writes.
Good call, lady.
I thought you said lady for a second.
Hey, lady. Hey,
good call, lady.
Good call, lady.
Clint says, "Hi, all. When I push my 2-year-old son on the swing, I pretend that I'm facing a series of well-aimed short balls. As the swing returns to my head high, I wait until the last minute, drop my hands and sway out of the way. I never get hit. If I push the swing from the front, my kid and all the other parents think I'm playing a fun game with my son. I'm fine."
We've had some good ones recently. That could be a Hall of Famer for me as well. There's nothing that American guy a couple of weeks ago.
You don't have to spend 800 words. You can achieve it in 50 words or less.
And for the listeners, can I just say that his final two words, "I'm fine," he doesn't actually add an apostrophe between the I and the M as well.
Or a full stop.
So it just kind of trails off. "I'm fine. That's it."
Or the previous "I'm," actually. I can see a red squiggly line underneath it in my Word document.
I can see the words "I'm fine" being typed when he's looking into the middle distance, down and to the left, not really looking or focusing on anything.
Definitely taking my straight at him.
Trying to think of other little like parenting moments that incorporate cricket skills. Pez, can you think of any?
Well, it's not as funny as that. Like this evening with my son, like, you're always just trying to find games to play with him. And like I just had like 20 minutes with him, and we had two mini soccer balls on a table, and he reveled in hitting them off the table, and I reveled in pretending that I was like a bit peeved that he was doing that and like scrambling to go and get it. So I'm basically practicing my catching skills. It's nothing for him, and placing it back on the table. And he found it hilarious that I was getting frustrated and I was hamming it up, and it's probably not what psychologists recommend.
Yeah, suppose his first words were, "Let's get 10
exactly.
Yeah, when I'm changing Eli's nappy, I use my wrists a lot. I don't usually, I'm not very wristy in other aspects of my life, but,
Okay.
That's just what I do. That could be construed differently. Linda Wu, she writes, "Dear TGC, my boyfriend and I recently went to Trent Bridge to watch Middlesex versus Notts Outlaws for the T20 quarterfinals. Whilst we are Notts members, we were mainly there for my boyfriend to get within touching distance of Owen Morgan and myself near AB de Villiers, who I consider an incredible cricketer, an absolute kilp, as in MILF, but cricketer I'd like to marry, an acronym. My boyfriend decided he'd be more than happy for us to invite AB into our bedroom. So we started talking through exactly how this would work. But as we got into the detail, it became apparent that my boyfriend would be more than happy to wait outside the bedroom door, patiently waiting and shadow batting for AB to become free and offer him a batting masterclass. My question to you is, Is my boyfriend simply demonstrating classic beta behaviour, or should I be concerned that he would happily allow me to do anything as long as it resulted in a coaching session and potential for him to improve his average above 6 and cement his position as a number 7? My second question, we saw Darwood Milan heading out for a warm-up and he left his kit at the top of the stairs to go back in the changing rooms, at which point I noticed he had 2 boxes. Why would he have 2? She asks. My third question is, were you at the Edgbaston tests on day 3 and were you taken aback when I stormed over and asked if you were TGC guys, or did I commit the sin of thinking all Australians sound alike? My apologies for the latter. Love the show. I've been sticking pins in a Nathan Lyon doll since March 2018. Please never have him on the show. For Linda.
A couple of belters today. Yeah, well, the first question answers itself. 2 boxes. I played with a guy who had 2 boxes, and a guy he batted with 2 boxes, and his opening partner was getting sledged one day, and he said, "What are you sledging me for?" The guy at the other end is wearing 2 boxes. So,
but what, how does he wear 2? Is it like an inner box, like inner gloves? Like what? How, where's the second box?
It'd be like
one smaller than the other. One's like a babushka doll.
That's right, babushka doll. Babushka doll. But for your penis.
I cover my penis with babushka doll of boxes. Can we just go to the top one as well? Like, I mean, yeah. Linda asks, is my boyfriend simply demonstrating classic beta behaviour? This is in relation to the question of whether he's okay for her to have any sexual relation with AB de Villiers so long as he gets a coaching lesson. Yes, that's classic beta behaviour.
That's literally cuckold behaviour.
That's classical. In the DSM.
Yeah.
That's in the psychological book, yeah. Yeah. That's in DSM of beta behaviour.
Yeah. DSM. Yeah.
To be fair, mutual interests are aligning here. Like, she has a romantic and probably sexual interest in AB de Villiers, and, you know, presumably her boyfriend wants her to be happy, but also he wants to get better at cricket. I mean, is this healthy?
It's a classic cuckolding scenario. That's where I thought it was going, but he said he wanted to coach
her. Yeah. Well, I mean, the concern there is the tryst does turn romantic and then he refuses to give a batting lesson. But the boyfriend's alone and no better at batting.
Yeah, a lot of couples these days are having open relationships and this seems like one that could work for both parties. So maybe, of course, there's another huge opportunity here that Linda's a guy called Glenn and we're being catfished again.
Damn Glenn and his catfish.
Oh,
just on that third question about Edgbaston Test Day 3, I don't recall that. Do you guys?
No, that wasn't me.
We were there. Mm. We were there on day three.
Yeah. Maybe this is Jim Maxwell.
I think I'd remember if a woman spoke to us.
That's true. It doesn't happen often.
Okay. Anonymous writes in. DTGC, long-time listener, first-time advice seeker. Despite successfully escaping the claws of cricket as a 13-year-old to seek higher honours in another sport, it was my best chance of getting rep kit to wear for the rest of time. Yes, this happens in every sport. At age 30, I am now known amongst my circle of friends and colleagues as the cricket guy. This is owing to a self-confessed love for the sport, a couple of years spent working around the professional game, albeit very much behind a laptop. In November this year, my now very corporate employer is holding their annual off-site meetup, and amongst the activities listed to partake in for team building is beach cricket. No doubt the poorer cousin of actual cricket, this activity poses a huge problem for my potential standing with the hierarchy in the office. Several other employees, upon seeing the activity, have already remarked to me their excitement to see what I can do. Herein lies the issue, writes Anonymous. Despite my love for the game, when it comes to actually picking up a bat or ball, I'm yuck. My last season spent in any form of organised cricket resulted in a season-long batting average of 4.23 and 6 ducks. While I can land the ball on the pitch, the sight of my ungainly 6-7 frame bowling spin is also a far cry from the perceived ideals of what good should look like on a cricket field, plus shit rig average chat. So I'm seeking your advice. Should I start training now, 2 months out, with the hope of lifting my ability enough to avoid embarrassment and potentially looking like a cuck in front of my colleagues and being forced to resign out of shame? Should I ignore all potential ramifications and remark to any negative criticism that beach cricket is rank? Should I instead surprise everyone and opt for beach volleyball with the beaters, knowing that the large frame could be an effective defensive force at the net to negate Janice from account spike? I don't know if any options are good, but if there's 3 blokes from the internet who could help, it's probably yous. Cheers, Anon. Beach volleyball is not beach art, I think, is it? It's fun.
I spent just the back half of that re-looking at that first paragraph and, like, why he was known as the cricket guy. So he says that he's actually... he escaped the clutches of cricket as a 13-year-old to seek higher honours in another sport.
Yeah, I know.
He's been working in the game behind a laptop.
Yeah.
Owing to a self-confessed love of sport. Because I feel like if you have benefited from... and not kind of, like... what's the word? Not kind of like torn down the reputation you've been growing, that you've been cultivating as a cricket person, then this is straight comeuppance and I don't really have much sympathy. You know, like if you've been happy to be the cricket guy
straight comeuppance
all the time hoping that no one ever sees you play the code, then this is kind of a lesson to you and perhaps a good thing, and I think you should possibly play the game. But then again, it's a very, very poor decision in a corporate environment to do that, and you should avoid that game at all costs.
Pez, I would suggest as the single man of the group that, like, first of all, it depends who you're trying to impress, because if it's like, if there's someone in the office that maybe he's caught Anonymous's eye, not that he suggested that, but I'm just thinking as a single man here, like, they most women, you know, won't really care what your bowling action looks like. That's been my experience anyway. And, like, they're probably more likely to be engaging in some frivolous activity of beach volleyball, which is fun because no one's good at it. So it's funny if you shit. Like, whereas cricket is just a sport where it's just wrapped up in, like, feelings and emotion and anxiety, whereas beach volleyball seems more fun to me. So, yeah, get yourself, if you're 6'7", get yourself to the net. Get in Janice's face from accounts and have a good afternoon.
Can I just point out that he's a 6'7" off spinner? So that is just a tremendous waste of natural resources.
It's still
and also just useless in beach cricket, where spin is completely redundant, like, unless you're playing on those, like, tourism-ad coastlines, just pristine, endless coastlines.
Now that I think about it, it's like, in fact, it's actually it's the best kind of player you want to be in this scenario is an okay cricketer, because most people with normal lives don't know what a good cricketer looks like.
Yeah.
And as, you know, three of us, obviously, you know, blah, 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 failed at club cricket, etc., you can obviously play the code a little bit. And that can often be a disadvantage in these games because you don't know how to actually play it socially.
That's right, Pez.
If you can play, someone bowls you the ball and you're like, well, I know where this has got to go and I don't get to hit people over the top very often in my actual cricketing life, so I really am trying to hold back doing that. But then you're trying to do this false kind of, oh, I'm just going to hit people catches thing, and that's really condescending as well. So it's hard to know how to actually play. It's like when you go to karaoke and someone gets up and sings a song and they're a professional singer and you're like, that's not how you meant to fucking do that. Like, you meant to be, the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak, you know, with karaoke. You don't want to be too good at it. You want to be pissed and excited but not great. And people are like, that's really good. And if you can take that to corporate cricket, I think you'll be really respected. So maybe you've got to play, just try your best. If you're shit, then people are just going to go, oh, he's having a go.
Depends where he also sits in the corporate hierarchy. Like, if he's trying to impress superiors or if he's trying to be friendly to inferiors, I'd be interested to know where he is on the corporate ladder in the corporate structure within his organisation. Then I could probably better advise how he should play.
Because
is it one of those ones where, like, you want to hit catches or just, like, be really friendly when Janice is bowling, but then, like, if someone who's going for the same promotion as you who plays, like, first or second grade comes in off the long run, and if you can just walk at them and smash them over their head, it doesn't matter what happens in accounts or any kind of strategic decision down the track, he'll always, or she will always know that you did that.
Like, there could be an underlie here of, like, someone could be in the office who, like, hasn't announced themselves as the cricketer. They kind of keep cricket separate from their life, and they're actually a good cricketer, and they could be waiting for you to reveal yourself as the cricketer and fail.
That's true.
That doesn't happen because most white-collar workers are shit at cricket, and there are very few outliers who are able to combine, you know, good, strong amateur cricket careers with a burgeoning actual white-collar job. True. So I just don't see many situations where some unexpected prodigy will emerge and dominate him. So I think if he's probably the best cricketer in his organisation, and he's just got to fucking figure it out.
That's such a... now that you said that, here goes, I've started to feel anxious. I mean, I'm a freelancer who works for myself, and I'm anxious about the situation now because someone could have played, like, under 16s or 17s and be a really humble, like, ambitious person who then just witnesses what's going on to Anonymous here and just comes in and like, I don't know what the stumps, whether it's proper stumps that are sent cartwheeling or if it's like a wheelie bin where the ball smashes into the bin, but it could be hugely humiliating.
Stumplosion?
Yeah.
Well, I am looking forward to our Christmas party this year, boys, where we've got a game and bowler goes to keeper, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that's going to be good when we go to the Bahamas this year too, because we've got tax evasion accounts going on.
Yep.
All right, that's a weird angle to take to finish the show.
Just open up a tax evasion account.
Can I open one, please?
Yeah, that's how it works. Costs a fortune to fly there, but it's worth it in the end. That's what Christmas Gay said. All right, the fifth test is is around the corner. Can Australia take the series 3-1, 2-1, or could it be 2-2? Those are your three options. That's what's going to happen. We'll see you next time on the Great Cricketer Podcast.